طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. Every once in a while, we get a glimpse into the leanings of the U.S. Congress concerning the Palestine-Israel issue. I do not have to tell you how historically pro-Israel the Congress has been. It is on the record. But is that overwhelmingly pro-Israel Congress beginning to change? Is the Palestinian narrative finally getting a foothold in the Congress? Perhaps, especially as younger, more racially and gender-diverse candidates challenge the white male domination of the House and Senate. Look at what an impact Representatives Rashida Tlaib, Ayanna Pressley, Ilhan Omar, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have made in challenging the discourse in the Democratic Party. But there is a long way to go. Josh Rubner, senior principal at Progress Up Consultants, offers such a glimpse into a hopefully changing Congress in an article he wrote for Mondelweiss News Service. He analyzes the vote on House Resolution 326, which may give us some insight into the shifting positions in the House of Representatives. I am now quoting from Josh Rubner's article. The House of Representatives narrowly passed along mostly partisan lines its most significant piece of legislation on the Israeli-Palestinian impasse this congressional session. House Resolution 326, a non-binding resolution, affirms that only a negotiated two-state resolution to the issue can both ensure State of Israel's survival as a Jewish and democratic state and fulfill the legitimate aspirations of the Palestinian people for a state of their own. The resolution was adopted 226 to 188, with two representatives abstaining. The much ballyhooed resolution, enthusiastically trumpeted by J Street, was never more than a recitation of woefully outdated policy prescriptions, but it certainly called for an end to Israeli military occupation and settlement activity and opposed Israel's annexation of the West Bank. However, the statement was significantly watered down in the House Foreign Affairs Committee by its chair, Representative Elliot Engel of New York, who presided over a process which stripped all reference to opposing occupation and restricted opposition to only the expansion of settlements. The resolution was further diluted by a last-minute amendment accepted by the Rules Committee, which states that it is in the enduring United States national interest to continue to stand by its ironclad commitments under the 2016 United States-Israel Memorandum of Understanding to provide Israel with a $3.8 billion per year in taxpayer-funded weapons. Representative Josh Gottheimer, Democrat, New Jersey, who sponsored the amendment, which was co-sponsored by a bipartisan group of 36 representatives, stated that its intent is to ensure no new conditions on U.S. aid to Israel. Taking aim at Democratic presidential candidates who have suggested conditioning aid to Israel, Gottheimer argued that this amendment is absolutely necessary because of the extreme and misguided views of some, especially several currently running for the highest office in the United States, who seemingly believe that assistance to Israel should be held hostage with new conditions until Israel makes concessions according to their beliefs. In a meager showing of even-handedness, the Rules Committee also included an amendment offered by Representative David Price, Democrat, North Carolina, and Mark Pocan, Democrat, Wisconsin, which stated that it is in the United States' interest to continue promoting the security, stability, and humanitarian well-being of Palestinians and their neighbors by resuming the provision of foreign assistance. Within the GOP caucus, only Representatives Bill Posey, Republican from Florida, Tom Reed, Republican, New York, Francis Rooney, Republican, Florida, Fred Upton, Republican, Minnesota, and Steve Watkins, Republican, Kansas, voted for the resolution. First-term progressives Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat, New York, Ilhan Omar, Democrat, Minnesota, Ayanna Pressley, Democrat, Massachusetts, and Rashida Tlaib, Democrat, Michigan, were the only Democrats to vote against the resolution, along with Palestinian-American Representative Justin Amash, independent from Michigan. Representative Shue Garcia, Democrat, Illinois, and Betty McCollum, Democrat, Minnesota, voted present. In total, at least 50 representatives spoke on the floor, issued press statements, and took to social media to express their views on the resolution. In general, Republicans used the opportunity to back the Trump administration's emerging plan that would amount to a one-state apartheid reality for perpetual Israeli domination over the Palestinian people. These representatives also used their statements to denigrate the Palestinian national rights, advocate for legislation to punish people for boycotting for Palestinian rights, and take pot shots at President Barack Obama for abstaining in 2016 on a UN Security Council reiterating the illegality of Israeli settlements. Democrats primarily rehashed the supposed benefits of a negotiated two-state solution, while refusing to offer any meaningful ideas on how to get there in light of both major Israeli political parties' opposition to the idea. Most also refused to countenance pressuring Israel in any concrete way to end its military occupation and illegal colonization of Palestinian land, prerequisites for a two-state solution. Typical of these statements was the one issued by Representative Jan Schakowsky, Democrat, Illinois, who proclaimed herself a Zionist and not naive to the challenges of achieving a negotiated agreement that produces two states for two peoples. She then listed those challenges as Hamas's governance of the Gaza Strip, and that the Palestinian Authority continues to incite and are doing nothing to prepare their population for peace. Only after establishing her anti-Palestinian bona fides did she mention the actions of the Israeli government and the Trump administration as being detrimental to the establishment of a Palestinian state. An outstanding and inspiring counterpoint was offered by Tlaib, who spoke on the floor with a keffiyeh draped around her neck, unconstrained by the pablum of stale two-state discourse. Tlaib opposed the resolution because it not only endorses an unrealistic and unattainable solution, one that Israel has made impossible, but also one that legitimizes inequality, ethnic discrimination, and inhumane conditions. Separate but equal didn't work in our country, and I can't see that it is possible in other countries, Tlaib continued. Given our nation's history of segregation, we should recognize when such injustices are occurring. We cannot be honest brokers for peace if we refuse to use the words illegal occupation by Israel. It is noteworthy that four of the six Democrats who either voted no or abstained, Garcia, McCollum, Omar, Presley, were co-sponsors of Representative Alan Lowenthal's, Democrat California, original version of the resolution. It is rare for co-sponsors not to vote for legislation they supported. Their votes were clear rebuke to the dilution of the resolution. Significantly, Pocan and Representative Pramila Jayapal, Democrat Washington, co-chairs of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, who both voted for the resolution, also held open the possibility of conditioning military aid to Israel. In separate statements, Pocan warned that congressional assistance could change if Israel continues to expand its illegal settlements, and Jayapal stated that, "My vote does not tie me at all to providing future aid to Israel should it continue to abuse the human rights of the Palestinians. We must maintain leverage over our assistance to ensure American taxpayer dollars are used in ways that are consistent with our values." Their statements augur well for the largest caucus in Congress proposing serious conditionality on weapons to Israel in the future. The vote on Resolution 326 reveals Congress to be more divided than ever in its approach to Israeli-Palestinian issues. From virtual unanimous opposition to Palestinian statehood during most of the Clinton administration to virtual unanimous support for it during the George Bush administration, the bipartisan consensus has irretrievably ruptured. Almost all Republicans now back Israel's one-state apartheid rule over the Palestinian people, whereas most Democrats still give lip service to Palestinian statehood without being willing to pressure Israel toward this end. However, things are changing for the better within the Democratic caucus, as a few representatives bravely challenge the two-state paradigm and test the waters for conditioning aid to Israel. That was an article written for Mondo Weiss by Josh Rubner. And now on to our feature presentation this morning, a speech that Nancy Murray gave before the Concord Humanist Society titled "The Gaza I Know." And Nancy knows Gaza. She's a founder of the Gaza Mental Health Foundation and frequent traveler to the area. She has also led several delegations over the years to the West Bank. Nancy is also founder of the Alliance for Water Justice for Palestine. Here is Nancy Murray speaking about "The Gaza I Know."
In February of this year, I was host to a young journalist and poet from the Gaza Strip, Ahmed Abu Artima. He spoke to a packed audience at Harvard Law School on the first leg of a speaking tour that took him to 9 American cities. Early in 2018, Ahmed had written a Facebook post suggesting that hundreds of thousands of Palestinians gather peacefully near the fence that was keeping them imprisoned to demand a life with dignity, an end to the blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip by Israel with U.S. backing, and a return to their homes from which Israel had expelled them 70 years before. That was the genesis of what became known as the Great March of Return. It began on March 30th, 2018, and has endured on a weekly basis since then. During that time, Israeli forces using live ammunition, massive amounts of tear gas, and drones have killed more than 300 unarmed demonstrators, including 46 children, 4 paramedics, and 2 journalists. Over 30,000 people have been injured, among them 173 journalists and 212 paramedics. Many were shot in the legs by snipers. One Israeli soldier has been killed outside the context of the protests. In Artema's words, quote, "The Great March represents a scream for life and a knock on the walls of the prison after those besieged prisoners decided not to accept the continuation of slow death," end quote. You may think this is just hyperbolic rhetoric, but after making some 15 visits to the Gaza Strip beginning in 1988, I find it an accurate reflection of a society that has lived under military occupation since 1967 and a draconian siege since 2007. Tonight I want to talk to you about the Gaza Strip as I have encountered it over the years and why the Israeli historian Ilan Pappe has written that Israel's policy towards Gaza is one of, quote, "incremental genocide." End quote. The Gaza Strip is a tiny spit of land, 26 miles long and 4 to 6 miles wide, that is wedged between the Mediterranean Sea, Israel, and Egypt. It has had a rich history from at least the 18th century BC. Formerly a district in British-controlled Mandatory Palestine, its population tripled in 1948, when 200,000 of the 750,000 refugees expelled from their homes by Jewish militias fled to Gaza. In the Six-Day War of 1967, the Gaza Strip, along with the West Bank and East Jerusalem, came under direct Israeli rule. The Gaza Strip is now home to 2 million people, nearly half of them children under 15 years of age. 70% are refugees and their descendants, many caged just miles from their former homes within Israel. To explain why so many Gazans are willing to risk their lives today in weekly demonstrations, I would like to describe to you what life has been like in the Gaza Strip since I paid my first visit there in 1988, during the early months of the vibrant uprising of the entire civil population known as the Intifada, which means shaking off in Arabic. What they were determined to shake off was a military occupation that since 1967 had ruled the population through more than 1,000 military decrees. All the freedoms that Americans take for granted were banned. Military orders decreed that 10 or more Palestinians gathered together could be imprisoned for up to 10 years and fined thousands of dollars each for, quote, "incitement." Raising the fingers in a V sign was incitement, as was raising the Palestinian flag or using the colors of the Palestinian flag on a school bag or hanging out clothes to dry so that the flag's red, green, black, and white colors hung near each other. All of these acts invited brutal reprisals. The landscape of both the West Bank and Gaza Strip was then, as today, strewn with the apparatus of occupation. Military jeeps and tanks, barbed wire, roadblocks, watchtowers, military checkpoints, as Palestinians faced endless waits and humiliating searches whenever they traveled any distance. More than a third of the male population had been imprisoned by military courts or detained for months and years without any charges whatsoever, and torture was and remains routine. In December 1987, the Intifada was ignited in Gaza's Jabalia refugee camp when an Israeli military truck crashed into a civilian car, killing four Palestinians. What began as an unplanned protest soon turned into a massive, unarmed civil uprising of the entire population, with women playing a prominent role. If you can, see the film Nyla and the Uprising. All across the occupied territories, Palestinians were involved in huge demonstrations, general strikes, the refusal to pay taxes. When Israelis imposed curfews that sometimes shut Palestinians into their homes for weeks at a time, they found ways to grow and share food. When Israel shut down the schools and universities, teachers taught students in underground classes. In 1988, as part of a human rights delegation, I visited hospitals that were full of young men and women who had endured the, quote, force, might, and beatings, end quote, ordered by Yitzhak Rabin, then the defense minister, to put down the Intifada. Many had been shot at close range. All night long, I would hear screams, gunshots, and the wailing of ambulances. 1,200 Palestinians were killed during this first uprising, even though stones were their only weapons. The Gaza economy suffered greatly during the first Intifada, and by 1992, it was so bad that when the United Nations advertised 8 jobs for garbage collectors, it got 11,655 applications. Under the so-called Oslo peace process of the mid and late 1990s, Gazans were cut off from jobs in Israel and increasingly from their fellow Palestinians in the West Bank. In 1994, after Baruch Goldstein, an Israeli settler from Brooklyn, murdered 29 Palestinians as they prayed in Hebron's Ibrahim Mosque, the Islamic Resistance Movement, or Hamas, carried out its first suicide bombing in retaliation. Now, I don't want to get into the thicket of Palestinian factional politics here, but just a word about the origin of Hamas. It emerged from the Muslim Brotherhood early in the Intifada, but was never part of the popular committees that coordinated the Intifada's activities. In fact, in its first year, many Palestinians suspected that Hamas was being used by Israel to cause divisions in Palestinian ranks. During my first visit, I witnessed the Israeli army forcing young men to scrub walls clean of slogans from the popular committees, while Hamas graffiti were untouched. Hamas was put on the U.S. government's list of terrorist organizations in 1995. The Oslo peace process led to the establishment of a Palestinian authority to run civil affairs in part of the West Bank and Gaza, but it totally failed to shake off the occupation and indeed made matters much worse. In fact, it repackaged the occupation, as we could talk about in the Q&A. Its failure led to a second Palestinian uprising in 2000, in which small armed groups and suicide bombers eventually participated, and Israel repeatedly used tanks, F-16s, and helicopter gunships against a defenseless civilian population. Some 3,000 people were killed in the Gaza Strip alone during the years 2000 to 2008, which is the per capita equivalent of 600,000 American dead. Among them were approximately 700 children. I would like to tell you about one incident whose aftermath I personally witnessed. In July 2002, the Palestinian Authority and Hamas reached an understanding that suicide bombings within Israel had to stop. just 90 minutes before a joint announcement to that effect was to be made on July 22nd. The Israeli Air Force dropped a one-ton bomb on an apartment building in an intensely crowded area of Gaza City, reportedly in the effort to kill a Hamas leader. 16 Palestinian civilians, including 11 children, perished. When I went to the site of the bombing the following day, I found people in shock and children's shoes and school supplies scattered through the rubble. The suicide bombings continued. Israel's withdrawal of its 4,000 settlers from the Gaza Strip in 2005 completed the transformation of the Strip into what the Israeli human rights groups B'Tselem called the largest prison on earth. It was totally encircled by walls, fences, and towers, with Israel continuing to control its air, sea, and land, and who goes in and out. And no sooner were the settlers gone than Palestinians were repeatedly subjected to eardrum-shattering sonic booms, daily drone surveillance, and frequent tank fire and missile strikes. The Israeli Defense Force could now attack the Gaza Strip with increasing impunity, as it did repeatedly from 2006. In January 2006, Palestinians held a legislative election that Jimmy Carter monitored and called fair and transparent. But because Hamas won the largest number of legislative seats, Israel and the U.S. refused to accept the results. The failure of a CIA-backed coup attempt in 2007 led to the takeover of the entire Gaza Strip by Hamas. And with that, Israel sealed Gaza off from the outside world and for many months permitted only 12 basic items to enter the Gaza Strip, and just enough of them to keep people alive. Electricity and fuel were severely rationed, and cement, soap, many medical supplies, potable water, and raw materials were kept out altogether as Israel made Gaza a laboratory for trying out its new weapon systems and finding the breaking point of human beings. That siege has been in place ever since with full U.S. support, as our government not only keeps Israel supplied with weapons, but maintains a no-contact rule with Hamas. Much has been made of rockets fired from the Gaza Strip into Israel, sometimes by very small militant groups other than Hamas, and they have indeed caused some fatalities and much fear. But in the words of the Israeli academic Ave Shalem, quote, "The figures speak for themselves. In the 3 years after the withdrawal of settlers from Gaza, 11 Israelis were killed by rocket fire. On the other hand, in 2005-7 alone, the IDF killed 1,290 Palestinians in Gaza, including 222 children," end quote. Those disproportionate figures have increased dramatically in the years since then. As the siege went on, Gaza experienced the, quote, "shock and awe," end quote, of Israel's military in what it called Operation Cast Lead from December 2008 to January 2009, Operation Pillar of Defense, November 2012, and the 2014 51-day onslaught named Operation Protected Edge. These offenses, with advanced weaponry, much of it supplied by the U.S., have killed thousands of Gazans, more than 800 of them children, and wreaked massive destruction on homes, schools, hospitals, municipal buildings, the industrial area, agricultural lands, and the vital infrastructure for water, sewage, and electricity. And after each aggression, the Israeli-imposed closure has remained in place, blocking the import of essential building materials and forcing people to live in the rubble of their homes. Such have been the methods used by Israel in its 7-decades-long project of destroying resistance to dispossession, for it is in the Gaza Strip, home to 1.3 million refugees, that Palestinian resistance has been at its most unrelenting and determined. For 12 years, the Gaza Strip has been virtually locked down from the outside world as an Israeli blockade on the territory has prevented movement in and out of people and goods. Thousands of patients have been barred from accessing urgent medical treatment. Students have not been able to get to universities in the West Bank and abroad, and the economy has been throttled. Now, all of the people of the Gaza Strip live in what is essentially a densely crowded, open-air prison under the incessant gaze of Israeli drones, surveillance balloons, and sentry guns that fire automatically from guard towers when alerted by sensors. Tanks and naval ships patrol the perimeters, and F-16s and Apache helicopters can unload their lethal cargo at any time. Frequent targets of these weapons are farmers who venture onto what used to be their rich agricultural land, but is now deemed by Israel part of an elastic, half-mile-wide no-go zone that consumes nearly a fifth of the Gaza Strip. With the Gaza Great March of Return, that no-go zone has become a killing field where demonstrators have been gunned down by snipers hundreds of yards from Israel's border barrier. I made my last trip to the Gaza Strip in April 2016. As co-founder in 2001 of the Gaza Mental Health Foundation, I manage from time to time to get a permit to enter with the help of international NGOs. It takes months to get a permit, but I did get one for only 4 days, unfortunately. My first meeting on entry was with an old friend, a Gaza doctor, who informed me that, quote, Gaza is terminally ill, end quote. Much of what I saw and heard over the next 4 days lent weight to this assertion. Nearly 2 years after the end of the 2014 attacks, which left much of the Gaza Strip in ruins, one bombed-out tower block still tilted dangerously over a Gaza City road. And although some new mosques and a new hospital had been built with funds from Qatar and Kuwait, I did not see much reconstruction in neighborhoods blasted by war. A big problem was the UN-brokered Gaza Reconstruction Mechanism, the GRM, which is designed to keep out materials that might have a, quote, dual use, say, for houses and tunnel construction. It's designed to keep these materials out of the hands of the Hamas government. GRM gives Israel a case-by-case approval power over all applications for construction material and pipes for repairing the infrastructure and housing, with a surveillance network of cameras and drones keeping track of how these materials are used. What I encountered when I visited some of the areas that had been hardest hit in 2014 were families living in partially destroyed buildings without four walls, which were death traps for kids and which lacked water, electricity, and any form of sanitation. According to UN figures, only 3,000 of the 18,000 homes that were entirely destroyed or severely damaged were habitable when I visited 2 years after the war. Not only has the pace of reconstruction been dismally slow, but it has provided few jobs for residents struggling with an unemployment rate of 50%. Deepening poverty, combined with the total lack of freedom of movement, hit young people especially hard, among them tens of thousands of university graduates with no prospects for employment. I was told these conditions have led to an upsurge in anger and despair and rise in suicide rates to a level never before seen in the Gaza Strip. But what makes the Gaza Strip terminally ill, as my doctor friend put it, has to do with the breakdown of the fundamental infrastructure needed to sustain life, the water, sewage, and electricity systems. In 2012, a UN report warned that the water and acute electricity crisis in the Gaza Strip would render it, quote, unlivable by 2020. In 2017, another UN report stated that, quote, sadly, as we check in on those same trends, the deterioration has accelerated, end quote. In that year, a five-year-old boy died after swimming during the summer heat in a seawater polluted with sewage. With 2020 rapidly approaching, electricity in the Gaza Strip is only sporadically available for 4 to 8 hours a day. 97% of the water supply is contaminated by seawater and sewage, and 80 million liters of raw sewage are dumped into the Mediterranean Sea every day, and giant lakes of sewage accumulate and sometimes overflow their banks. Why is this happening? It is a complicated picture, but the major factor is the ongoing siege and refusal to expedite the entry of some of the material needed to fix the basic infrastructure of the Gaza Strip, because this would require dealing with some Hamas officials. The few EU and World Bank water and sanitation projects that have been completed have been unable to function on a regular basis because of the severe fuel and electricity shortage. I find it simply unconscionable that Israel and the U.S. are prepared to let 2 million people fester in these conditions and die because of them. Today, infant and maternal mortality rates are swiftly rising. But alongside this bleak picture is another reality that I need to convey in the time remaining to me. It would do great injustice to the spirit of the people of the Gaza Strip to leave you with the impression that they are sunk in depression and at the end of their collective tether. On several occasions during my brief visit in 2016, I again experienced the personal warmth, generosity, and exuberance that made the Gaza Strip such an enticing place when I first visited it, during the hopeful days of the First Intifada and during many subsequent trips. An astonishing fortitude was evident during a conference I spoke at, organized by the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, which was attended by 800 people from around the Gaza Strip. The imperative of addressing the collective injustice inflicted on the Palestinian people has made the GCMHP, that's the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, more than a mental health service provider, as typically understood in the West. Instead, it is engaged in human justice work, recognizing that human rights, security, and the quality of life are fundamental to mental health, and that mental health needs of Palestinians cannot be fully met without a social, economic, and political transformation. The director of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program is Dr. Yasser Abu Jameh, who lost 27 members of his extended family in a single missile strike in 2014. He declared in his keynote speech that, quote, planting hope is our main duty, end quote. And I saw the work of instilling hope in the energy with which the GCMHP and other organizations I visited labored to heal the spirit of traumatized children and to bring hope to young people who felt they had no future and to women at the receiving end of a vicious spiral in domestic violence. I saw it in the determination of students, men and women working together, to transcend their confinement by making creative use of the internet and becoming vigorous advocates for an end to human rights abuses across the region. Had I been there longer, I am sure I would have discovered beacons of hope all around the Gaza Strip. For in the context of Gaza, the word resilience has been taken to a whole new level. So what steps can we in this room take to nourish hope among a people who have for too long experienced the full weight of the more than $130 billion in just military aid that successive U.S. governments have given Israel? Here are three concrete things you can do. First, you can support the indispensable mental health work being undertaken in the Gaza Strip by donating to the Gaza Mental Health Foundation, That's the organization started in the U.S. To support the mental health work in Gaza. And its website is www.gazamentalhealth.org. That's www.gazamentalhealth.org. Second, you can sign up to get more information about the catastrophic environmental condition, not just in Gaza, but also the West Bank, from the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine. This is a group that is raising consciousness about the many ways Israel is using water as a weapon against the Palestinian people, including in the Gaza Strip. And they have a website full of resources, which is www.waterjusticeinpalestine.org. And finally, you can insist that Israel's 12-year-old siege of Gaza and its 52-year-old occupation must be brought to an end. You can bring this message to your friends, your neighbors, your church and community groups, your local newspaper, and most crucially, your elected representatives. And the time to do it has never been more ripe than now, when there are growing signs within the U.S. of a shift in public attitudes towards Palestine, especially among young people. Changing U.S. policy is obviously a very tall order, but I want to close with words attributed to Mahatma Gandhi. Quote, "Strength does not come from physical capacity," he said. "It comes from an indomitable will," end quote. I saw in the Gaza Strip an indomitable will that has helped sustain its people through so many difficult years. If we develop the indomitable will to work for freedom, equality, and justice in Palestine and Israel, who knows what we can achieve? Thank you.
You have been listening to Palestinian rights activist Nancy Murray speaking about the Gaza I know. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.